Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today, well, it's that time of the month where it's just me, prattling on about a topic guest-free, if you will. Just me, a microphone, and a subject that interests me, and, well, I hope you too. So today, I want to talk to you about the history of one of America's most important institutions, one that affects all of us who have been involved in practicing medicine in the United States. And I want to talk about the United States Food and Drug Administration, better known as the FDA, or purportedly to show that one is in the know, just FDA. In other words, dump the definite article, because FDA is, as the dictionary would define, something previously mentioned or known, something unique, and that it is. Of course, FDA is responsible for what goes on in the good old US of A. Other countries have their own regulatory mechanisms, MHRA in Britain, Health Canada for that great nation, and Therapeutic Goods Administration for Australia, and so on and so forth. In China, the National Medical Products Administration is very stringent, and in 2007, the director at the time, Zhong Xiaoyu, I hope I've pronounced that properly, was executed for accepting bribes. So this is serious stuff. Since people first ascertained that what they put in their mouths might impact health, a series of customs and behaviors have, well, gradually imposed themselves on our cultures. For instance, we clink glasses as a toast so that if one chalice is poisoned, some of the deathly fluid would splash into the other person's glass. And if one person fails to quaff deeply, he would also avoid the adulterated ale like it was poison. Well, yes, because that's exactly what it is. The Emperor Claudius was knocked off by poison in AD 54, and in ancient Rome, a food taster or pregustator was employed to check whether meals were dodgy in a dangerous way. Actually, the Queen even today has a food taster, or I think it's probably for other reasons. The first legal regulation of food came about as early as 1202, when King John of England, bless his cotton socks, enacted the Assize of Bread, which prohibited the adulteration of bread with such ingredients as ground peas or beans. Nowadays, of course, with gluten in the news, bread, if you can call it such, made of such things, is positively wolfed down. Regulation of drugs, however, took a little longer. No surprise. You couldn't really imagine someone providing legal oversight of your local witch brewing up a deadly nightshade potion. It wasn't until the year 1813 that the first federal biologics law was passed. Can you believe it? 100 years ago. The United States enacted it to tackle the counterfeiting of Edward Jenner's smallpox vaccine, which was being reproduced and distributed by scammers who were known as hucksters. Of interest, and it is to me, the word huckster, it comes from an old English word, huck, meaning to bargain. And that's an ancient Anglo-Saxon word, originally a name for someone who sells second-rate goods. So quite appropriate, really. Fast forward nearly a century, and things quite rationally get a tad more complex. The Biologics Control Act was passed in 1902 to ensure purity and safety of all serums, vaccines, and similar products used to treat or prevent human disease. A few years later, in 1906, the Food and Drugs Act was passed and signed into law by President Theodore Roosevelt, which prohibited the exchange of all misbranded and adulterated foods, drinks, and drugs. Of legend, the teddy bear was named for Roosevelt. I wonder if misbranded cuddly toys were ever covered by the act. Then, in 1914, the Harrison Narcotic Act was enacted, a first of its kind in law that required prescriptions for certain products and also demanded doctors and pharmacists keep records. There were some famous cases of doctors who were, well, shall we say, rather too fond of the medicines they dispense. For instance, one William Halstead, a surgical deity who introduced, among other things, local anesthesia, enjoyed using cocaine. By the way, if you're interested in Halstead and the early days of medicine and surgery in America, there's a book by Dr. Gerald Imber called Genius on the Edge, and it's a cracking good read. I highly recommend it. So maybe those kind of instances help lead to the Harrison Actum. That I'm not sure about. Couldn't find out, but I'm going to keep searching. With drug parity and assurance of safety, demands on proper labelling and claims and prescriptions all now decreed by law, the soil was now fertile for FDA to bloom. And in fact, the gestation of FDA took another 13 years, starting life as the Bureau of Chemistry. It was originally called the Food, Drug and Insecticide Administration, before becoming the much more succinctly named Food and Drug Administration, FDA, in 1930. In its maiden years, the department focused on tightening up pre-existing legislation with drivers like a poisoning in 1937 involving a solvent called diethylene glycol. This tragically killed over 100 people, many of whom were children. An early initiative sought to update Roosevelt's now obsolete Food and Drugs Act, passing a number of revisions, including, well, extending control to cosmetics and therapeutic devices, requiring new drugs to be shown to be safe before bringing them to market, and providing that safe tolerances be set for substances which were known to have poisonous potential. And this was FDA's first congressional milestone, culminating in the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. Today, FDA regulates $2.6 trillion, yes, trillions worth of products every year. My brain cannot even wrap itself around how massive that is. And that represents about 20 cents of every dollar spent by American consumers. Again, $2.6 trillion. There are several divisions of FDA and a bunch of new laws to address the regulation and accessibility to food, drugs, devices, and other substances. For instance, and this is a fascinating a collection of facts, if you will, there was the Kefauver-Harris Amendments of 1962, which were inspired by the thalidomide tragedy in Europe. If people don't recall this, this was a drug brought to market, taken by women in the early stages of pregnancy, and it caused some pretty shocking deformities of the children born to mothers taking that drug. And this movement ordered manufacturers to do more to prove drug safety and effectiveness. Actually, there's a fascinating little tidbit associated with thalidomide. It's a bit of a diversion from the main topic that I'm talking about, but hey, there's no one else here with me, so I can say what I want, right? There was a friend of Francis Kelsey who drove much focus on on thalidomide, and this was a chap named Dr. John Nestor. He was a pediatrician and FDA reviewer, and in the 1980s, he was renowned for driving around Washington, D.C. on the freeway fast lane at exactly the speed limit of 55 miles an hour. In fact, he would pull into the fast lane and stick to exactly that speed limit. This irritated a lot of people, and he came forward and admitted to this and stated that he saw this sort of like his duty to regulate traffic speeds. In his honor, the word nestering entered common parlance to mean someone who drove in that manner. I hope you don't mind these little departures, but I love stories like that. So back to FDA, the topic at hand. And in 1976, the medical device amendments were introduced. And this followed a Senate finding implicating medical devices in bad outcomes and demanded oversight for safety and effectiveness for devices. As someone who practiced surgery for many years and was involved in, you know, playing a small role in bringing some devices to the market, it was fascinating to learn about this history. So this division is now housed at the CDRH, the Center for Devices and Radiologic Health in Maryland on the FDA campus. It's got sweeping powers to mandate what pieces of medical kit make it to market. And what about the scale of this organization? Well, for medicines in particular, the FDA has approved over 20,000 prescription medicines and 400 biologics and has an organizational 2020 budget of about $6.1 billion. I enjoyed learning about the genesis of FDA and preparing for this podcast. And although any regulatory body is bound to be the target of disdain, we've got to have checks and balances in place to ensure public safety. From my perspective, having worked with many medical companies on various drug, device, and biotech projects, our colleagues in the industry, to my mind, are hardworking, sincere, and honest people who, like us, put patients first. They would never dream of doing anything untoward that might lead to human harm. But medicine and science is complicated, and some kind of peer review is critical. I've personally been to FDA on a number of occasions, and I can attest to the complexity of what is now a very large agency that employs over 15,000 people, and I'm sure that they come to work every day wanting to do a good job. I imagine what they're going through now in the midst of a global pandemic, and know that they, and every national regulator, have an awesome responsibility to do the right thing. Get medicines, vaccines, new ventilators, ECMO devices, and so on and so forth through the process to ensure that sick patients are helped. They've got to do it swiftly, but they have to do it safely, and it's their responsibility. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. I've pretty much exhausted what I know about the subject, although, as I say, I'm going to continue to read. Thank you for listening to today's episode, and please do join me again next Friday for another episode of the EMG Health Podcast. Take care of yourself, stay safe, and stay informed. Knowledge is the vaccine that repels stupidity. Bye for now.